Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Even though I've, used to teach the class we call touchy-feely and have a long association with that methodology, I'm not promoting what we might call a touchy-feely leadership style. You know, I think it's really important for a leader to be in touch with his or her emotions and to be able to express them effectively, because the leader's emotions are contagious and people will be looking at the leader to understand how he or she is feeling. It's perfectly appropriate for leaders to be, in some cases, quite directive, quite authoritative, quite commanding. But the leader should be choosing the way of interacting that's going to allow them to, have the greatest impact and result in the, the best business outcomes. There should be a degree of thoughtfulness as opposed to a kind of reflexive, well, this is just how I show up.
Why did I become an executive coach? I saw lots of great people fail to get ahead at work, while their much less talented peers blew right past them. That made me furious, but also curious. What were great people getting wrong? It came down to helping them re-examine what drove success and then helping them make critical shifts, one hard truth at a time.
Feel like you're doing everything you were told, but you're not moving ahead at work nor having the impact you seek? Then welcome to 97% Effective with Michael Winderoth, where we skip feel-good, happy talk and engage experts in pointed conversations about what it really takes to move the needle at work and your career. So if you feel stalled or frustrated or seek that extra edge as you move to the next level, then look no further. This is the Hard Truths Playbook you never got.
Hi, I'm Michael Winderoth, and you're listening to 97% Effective. Last week, I spoke with Ed Batista, executive coach to C-suite leaders, about nice people and power struggles. How highly conscientious people need to better understand power, not shy away from it, if they want to be effective and get things done. In that episode, we talked about how he got into coaching, but mainly dove into areas that show up in both our coaching practices: reconciling ethics and power, and how clients gain self-awareness. Ed also shared how he draws from the research of David McClelland on motivational theory, affiliation, achievement, impulse control, and how we need to find the right balance among those if we wish to successfully sustain our career at the highest organizational levels and not get derailed. In this episode today, touchy-feely. You got it. Touchy-feely. Ed and I are going to shift and go deep into his years as facilitator and lecturer at our alma mater, Stanford Business School, where he worked and taught in the famed course Interpersonal Dynamics, also known by its nickname Touchy-feely. If your eyes are rolling and you're thinking California kumbaya, stay tuned. We're going to break down the roots of the course and have Ed make a strong case for why it is a fantastic laboratory to understand power and influence, and how that's going to help you as you rise and become a senior leader. And not to steal the punchline, but Ed is definitely not advocating a feel-good, touchy-feely approach to leadership. Quite the contrary. Ed Batista is an executive coach to CEOs and senior leaders based in Silicon Valley. He is a prolific writer and thinker with writing in Harvard Business Review and his blog at edbatista.com. Ed spent 15 years as lecturer at Stanford Business School and spent more than a decade before that in management roles, launching three organizations. Ed, welcome back to 97% Effective, where we'll get much more touchy-feely today.
Oh, Michael, it's a pleasure to be here.
Ed, let's talk about, you know, we referenced it earlier, your work in interpersonal dynamics. So this is a famed class at Stanford Business School. We were in a T group together. It is known, I think, as touchy-feely, which I think carries a lot of baggage, gives it a certain perception as being very soft, fluffy, California authentic. We can talk about that. But I'd love to hear, you know, how that has most influenced your coaching. And in particular, to this point we've both talked about, you know, when you teach interpersonal dynamics, you are one of the few people that has Jeff's work on power in the syllabus, right? Most people this, just to simplify it, right, as these are two courses at Stanford, very popular, that are diametrically opposed. Nice and soft, Machiavelli. Very much caricatures. Let's dive into that. Talk about the influence and how it shows up. And I think this is a really rich topic to explore.
I totally agree. And I think first, it's important to recognize that, you know, Jeff's work on power and, you know, interpersonal dynamics, T groups, AKA touchy-feely, are viewed in these caricaturish ways. You know, Jeff is caricatured as a sort of Machiavellian figure, you know, learn how to be powerful and influential, essentially like be a jerk and that's how you win. That's not what Jeff believes. That's not what he really thinks. It's how some people misinterpret what he's teaching. Similarly, in touchy-feely, and I think the baggage related to touchy-feely is related to that title is part of what contributes to the caricature. The idea is, oh, you know, learn how to be nice and make friends, develop a bunch of warm relationships, and that's how you're successful. And, you know, that's really not what T groups are about. I think it's useful. You mentioned the California Association. T groups go back to the 40s. They were devised in Connecticut under the leadership of a guy named Kurt Lewin, or Lewin, as he's sometimes called. They became extremely popular in academia, government, the military in the 50s and early 60s. In the late 60s, it began teaching a course related to T groups at Stanford, and then, you know, became extremely popular over the years. But T groups are not a California invention and certainly not a Stanford invention. I think that the perception, though, of T groups as a kind of, you know, a place to develop warm connections is in some sense a function of the fact that most people do one T group and stop. You know, that was, you know, our experience as students. You know, we both had our T group together in the fall of 1999, and it was only by a kind of a strange set of unexpected circumstances that I wound up getting back involved in that world. I did another T group in 2006 when I was thinking about launching my coaching practice. That contributed to me becoming more actively involved at the business school, and then I wound up, you know, many years later teaching the class. And, you know, when you go through T groups multiple times, and I wound up spending 1,500 plus hours in T groups, you realize that they are incredible laboratories for learning about power. Mm. And you know, a source of power is developing, you know, close and connected relationships with people. Mm-hmm. But that's just one source of power. And so I think, you know, there's something of a misunderstanding of the role that T groups can play in the process of learning how to be more influential.
Yeah, say more about that in terms of the laboratory for understanding power. You alluded to, right, you know, the ability to build strong, you know, trusting relationships. You know, I don't know if they still do, you know, the influence line where how you're perceived, but what are other avenues? I know, you know, we're not going to break down how touchy-feely works here, but, you know, as this idea of the laboratory, what else is you find most useful or most transferable to what you do?
Let's demystify it a little bit. And, first recognizing that, T is T for training. And it's useful to bear in mind that, you know, back in the day in the 40s and 50s, they actually had other groups, you know, known by other designations, but T group is the one group that wound up becoming sort of the most popular and the most useful. A T group is a setting in which, at least at the GSB, which is the program that you and I are both most familiar with, but by no means the only configuration, consists of 12 students and two facilitators. And they don't really have a task, which is a sort of upending and ungrounding experience. Often when we, you know, if we're going to sit down with a bunch of people, we would expect to have a task. T groups aren't given a clearly defined task, which often people perceive initially as sort of confusing. What are we here to do? What are we here to accomplish? Now, they rapidly become sort of vehicles for, you know, various forms of interpersonal communication. Students at the business school are primed to view tier groups as a vehicle for feedback. We're going to give each other some feedback. And they're very useful in that way. But that's just a starting point. Ultimately, there are various, a whole host of ways in which people learn to connect with each other and ultimately exert influence. One of the most useful, dimensions of T group is that it is not it doesn't have a very, very clearly defined set of activities or tasks to accomplish, which means that the members themselves need to decide, well, what do I think we should be doing? And you reliably see early on in T groups, people struggling to figure out, well, what should we be doing? And if I have an idea about what we should be doing, or if I don't like an idea that somebody else is proposing, how do I exert some influence? The facilitators, and a word that's very deliberately chosen, they're not the leaders of the group. They are differentiated authority figures. They have a lot of experience. They can weigh in various ways, but they don't have special powers that the other members of the group lack. And what you see as a group evolves is that other members ultimately exert more and more leadership over the direction of the group. And in some ways saying, this is where I think we should be going, or this is the kind of interaction that I want to have. And in some ways resisting, I don't think we should do that. I don't think that would be helpful. So it becomes a very rich laboratory for understanding, well, how is power working in this particular system? Mm. And you don't necessarily universalize. It's not as if the lessons learned in a single T group apply to, all groups of people everywhere. But, you do it often enough, you start to realize, oh, there are some reliable and predictable patterns in small groups.
And you have worked, you've taught around interpersonal dynamics. My experience with it much more limited. It does feel that that is an artificial environment where power is a lot of the interpersonal. You're not going to be able to necessarily replicate an organization where there are resources, right, that are controlled by one or the other. So it's really there kind of the interpersonal soft parts of influence and power.
Well, but I would push back on a couple of aspects of that. One is, I think T groups, in a sense, they are certainly deliberately engineered, but they're actually less artificial, right? It's just like we don't have the tools or trappings at our disposal. Initially, like the facilitators have their identity as facilitators. They have the title of facilitator. They have some expertise. But as the group goes on, that distinction diminishes. So it's not as if we're in a permanent hierarchical role. So in an organization, there's a lot of artificiality, right? You have a title, I have a title, and we're in roles on an org chart. We have a bunch of, in the sort of classic old school example, you've got the corner office and I'm sitting out in the hallway. There are a bunch of essentially like artificially created constructs that signify power and influence. In a T group, all of that stripped away. It's one of the reasons why it's actually a particularly useful laboratory to learn about power. Because, and again, the facilitator member distinction starts to erode, doesn't entirely go away, nor should it. But ultimately, it's not a hierarchical group. It's, it's 14 people, at least in the Stanford configuration, figuring out how to make decisions collectively, how to decide what to do and what not to do. And all you're left with are your tools, the ways you can interact with people. So it really gives you a great sense of what do I do? Like if I want to influence a group, if I want to take the group in a certain direction, I want to have a certain conversation with somebody, or I want to resist a certain conversation, how do I do that? How do I get that done? And I don't have the tools and trappings of organizational life. I just have, my own behavior. Now you can take, you learn how to use those tools, and especially, and more specifically, the tools of emotion regulation, both dialing it up if I want to step into conflict, or, be very effusive, and dialing it down if I want to lower the temperature. Emotion regulation goes in all sorts of directions. You can take those anywhere with you, and very relevant to organizational life.
And that for you as a coach, Ed, and your clients, I imagine many of your clients have perhaps, or most of them have not been through a T group. So is more you bringing in those elements or the awareness of what you have seen in T groups, teaching it, both the research and the experimental labs, yeah. What tends to work. You're bringing that in as you partner with a client.
But here, I also want to, I think something that's kind of counterproductive about the way T groups are understood is that they're viewed as this sort of magical black box. And you don't really understand what happens. And similarly, like, oh, you have to go to some special place like Stanford Business School to experience this stuff. That's, not true. I think it's especially the idea of emotion regulation. I mean, emotion regulation is a critical theme in my practice. I think it's directly related to this topic of power and influence that we're talking about today. The ability to understand what we're feeling, to in some cases dial up those emotions, and especially when you're the leader, because the leader's emotions are contagious. So if you in a leadership position want to have a powerful influence on people, you got to be able to understand what you're feeling and express those feelings in ways that are going to be helpful and register with others. And that doesn't mean just like turn the dial up to 11 and, bark at people. I mean, under some circumstances that helps. Under a lot of circumstances, it's very counterproductive. Can you get some special kind of training in emotion regulation and related tools and techniques in a T group? Absolutely. Do you have to do a T group? No. Do you have to go to Stanford Business School? Hell no. There are lots of ways to pursue work in these dimensions. And it actually very much goes back to the simple process of structured reflection, right? I mean, a lot of what I'm doing with clients is helping them understand, okay, let's go back to this, this meaningful experience that you just had. You had a tough negotiation. You had a tough conversation. You had to fire somebody. You had to close a client. How'd it go? How'd you feel at the moment? What can you remember about the behaviors that you exhibited and the other person exhibited? How is what you were feeling or what you perceived the other person feeling? How did those emotions influence your behaviors? And what was the outcome? And what might you do differently the next time around? So, the simple process of structured reflection, simple, but something that's still, being in a relationship with a coach is sort of a useful spur to conduct that process on a repeated basis, but you don't need to be with a coach to have that kind of dialogue with yourself. That's work that you can do without participating in a T group or anything like that.
Yeah, so the structured reflection definitely can be learned. And, so that sounds like a huge part of your practice as we talk about, the emotional regulation, the awareness to show up as you need to in a particular situation. You gave kind of an example. You might have to fire someone. You can still do that compassionately. You may need to build consensus. And so it's bringing those emotions, the right ones you need for that particular situation.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
You've been listening to 97% Effective with your host, executive coach, Michael Winderoth. If this interview is making you think, make sure to share it with a friend. Now, back to our interview.
And I like the saying that we're, only as successful as our clients, right? They are in there doing the work. This part around emotional regulation, again, it can be learned. It is a skill. Having to go through that, the structural reflection helps. Is there any sign, right, that you look for when you're doing that, discovery conversation, that you feel like this is not going to be a client that's going to be able to learn this or has the awareness or the patience, right? When you get up very high, yeah. Very short patience, I think is very challenging for us as coaches. Is there a telltale sign or for someone out there, right? That they may be, they really need to work on it and think about the emotional regulation?
Sure. Well, first I really emphasize that in my work. I mean, even though I've, used to teach the class we call touchy-feely and have a long association with that methodology, I'm not promoting what we might call a touchy-feely leadership style. You know, I think it's really important for a leader to be in touch with his or her emotions and to be able to express them effectively, because the leader's emotions are contagious, and people will be looking at the leader to understand how he or she is feeling. That doesn't in the least mean that, I think that leaders need to or should be adopting some what we might call sort of, you know, lowercase t touchy-feely sort of mannerisms. It's perfectly appropriate for leaders to be in some cases, quite directive, quite authoritative, quite commanding. But the leader should be choosing the way of interacting that's going to allow them to, have the greatest impact and result in the, the best business outcomes. There should be a degree of thoughtfulness as opposed to a kind of reflexive, well, this is just how I show up. So I do, let clients know, look, I'm going to be most effective for you as a coach if you are interested in understanding what you're feeling, how you're expressing those emotions, how other people are responding to those emotions. If you don't want to do that work, I'm just going to be, I'm going to be less effective, because I know what a critically important tool it is for leaders to be successful and have impact. A more specific variation I'll touch on, which is another theme that you and I have riffed on in the past, is what I call the difference between force and power.
Yeah.
Right. Force is, strength or energy as an attribute of action. Power is just the ability to have an effect. And a lot of folks that I've worked with, and I know folks that you've known too earlier in their careers, believe, sometimes rightly, they have to act very forcefully, to have impact. They've got to be very forceful, they got to literally, pound the table in some cases. And the dilemma is that as you grow more senior, those behaviors become less and less effective, right? They are too overwhelming to people. And so, what I'm often working with folks who've ascended into more senior roles with on is understanding, okay, the feelings, maybe this is a feeling of like frustration that the goal wasn't accomplished, or anxiety that the business seems to be faltering. Are those feelings being channeled into forceful displays that people are finding, counterproductive? Because when you think about, certainly when I think about the most powerful people I know, they don't act forcefully. They tend to speak slowly. They tend to act slowly, which doesn't mean they never, doesn't mean they never bring the hammer. I mean, occasionally, like, that's a tool that should be in your kit. But it's not as if they go to that reflexively. That's a deliberate choice that they make in specific circumstances.
Yeah, that's a fantastic article. I will put it in the show notes. Again, I think showcases your writing. You have a clip from the Godfather and calling out, right, that we do think very one-dimensionally sometimes. Force is very kind of masculine, bang on the table, shout, etc. Silence, the different things you've alluded to. This idea of having the complete toolkit that's needed in the right situation. And I want to call out too here, Ed, because, we started talking about nice people and power. I think, and another article that you have written, I think is a big theme, you talk a lot about empathy, right? Awareness. And most people over equate that with, if I'm empathetic, that means I have to be nice, or I have to settle for a work that's not up to snuff. And you talk a lot about how we want a high empathy so we understand where people are coming from, but we also want high accountability. Anything you just want to add to that? Because I feel like that's another, we don't want people to come to the conclusion here that you are singing Kumbaya and that it's, a serious job, working with CEOs. There's a lot in the line. They need to get stuff done.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad that you raised that topic, Michael. So first, let me just note, in Jeff's, I believe it's not his latest book, Seven Rules of Power, that's different, but in one of his earlier books, I think the book called Power, he lists out, I believe it's also seven, attributes of influential people. And one of Jeff's seven attributes of influential people is empathy. Right now, Jeff is certainly not promoting a touchy-feely leadership style, and so I think it's really important to understand, well, why does Jeff Pfeffer, the sort of the guru of power, why is he talking about empathy? Well, in part because if you don't understand how another person is feeling, you're going to be a lot less effective in your ability to influence them. You need to know what another person is feeling. Are they scared? Are they angry? Are they happy? Are you going to do something that's going to impact those feelings one way or the other? And I think it's also really critical to recognize that empathy is not agreement. You know, the ability to understand what someone is feeling and to have a, you know, to have, you know, to sort of sense that feeling yourself and to convey that you feel it doesn't mean that you agree. I work with people all the time, leaders who have to ask people to do hard things. And people are, you know, they're frustrated, they're scared, they're possibly resentful. You know, the leader needs to be able to understand those feelings. Okay, so you've asked somebody to do a hard thing and they're frustrated or scared or resentful. If you're blind to those feelings, then, you know, you could be surprised in a very nasty way when suddenly those feelings blow up. But if you empathize with those feelings, then you're able to get into a very different posture, have a very different conversation with people, and often help to diffuse some of those feelings. But that doesn't mean that you agree. Doesn't mean that you agree that those feelings are justified. Doesn't mean that you're going to change your opinion on whether or not this hard thing has to be accomplished. So, a theme that comes up all the time in my practice, empathy is not agreement. And the capacity for empathy is a hallmark of powerful and influential people. Now, are we saying that every single powerful and influential person, you know, has the capacity for empathy? No, of course not. But in my experience, developing a capacity for empathy is a tool that's going to enable anyone to be more powerful and influential.
Yeah. So on this topic, Ed, I want to not push back, but I kind of nuance on this. You know, I've also worked now for quite a few years with Jeff in his course. Thousands, actually, of executives who have gone through that I've coached and worked with around elements of it. I prefer, and I find that it's more helpful on that dimension instead of using empathy. And I want to know how you feel about this, right? The idea of perspective taking, which is understand where the other person's coming from, their views on it, how they're going to feel, how they may act, how it may affect them, to then use that in terms of, you know, how you're going to approach the situation. And where I draw from there is, you know, pretty good research in kind of in negotiations that, you know, and this is to your point of a strength taken too far can become a weakness, which is that, you know, when people think about empathy, you've got to walk in someone's shoes, which causes in negotiation research, they will then not take, right? You know, when you're cutting a negotiation, you will tend to pull back, right? You don't want to hurt that person's feelings, again, to this part that we were talking about before. And so when we kind of shift that word, and I know for you, words matter a lot, I find that it is a subtle nuance, but it helps people a lot still take perspective, but then not become overly, I don't want to do this because, you know, I need consensus and everyone to be happy, which you are never going to get. And thoughts on that or reactions?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, first, I would say I don't think these are mutually exclusive ideas at all. I think the process of empathizing necessarily requires a degree of perspective taking, right? Let me step back from my role in this situation. Let me step back from these immediate circumstances and try to understand, well, what's going on here? What are the other person's priorities? How are they conceptualizing the situation? Do they view it as like an antagonistic struggle, or are they approaching it in some other way? And a limitation there is that's very cognitive, right? It's very intellectual. I think what gets missed is the feeling part. And I think this is particularly important also in distinguishing certain circumstances. Like if we think of a negotiation, often we're viewing it as, it involves parties who are not, in the same enterprise. And it may be just like a kind of a one-off circumstance. And what's actually more, and of course, that happens and comes up in my practice on a regular basis. What's more common, though, is a less of a formally structured negotiation and some kind of a need to reach agreement between a leader and his or her employees. And if the leader simply views that as a negotiation, and of course, on occasions, there are very explicit negotiations around, you know, compensation and so forth between a leader and employees. But it's a fuzzier process of reaching agreement. And I would say and it's also a relationship in which people are going to be working together quite closely, having repeated interactions, maybe over, you know, years. If the leader only views that from an intellectual perspective, cognitively, and sort of takes perspective, it's a missed opportunity to explore the emotional piece and signify to this person, make it very clear, I appreciate the feelings that you're having in this experience. And I have a different perspective. I have a different point of view. But I do appreciate, I do acknowledge, and maybe even feel those feelings. And I think, you know, to the point you raised, sure, if you get caught up in the other person's feelings when it actually should be viewed as an arm's length negotiation, might you underperform? Absolutely. But in my experience, the relationship between leaders and employees, you know, it's different. And sometimes there are explicit negotiations, but far more often there's the need for the leader to be able to convey to the employees, I appreciate how you feel, and I have a different point of view. Mm.
Yeah, good point there around emotions and the importance and how empathy does tap more, getting people to think about that. That's a great point. To close or add one comment here on the touchy-feely interpersonal dynamics, I would say, you know, that people should be exposed to both that and Jeff's. And I think it's, you know, having worked with a lot of the MBAs or executive ed who have taken both, I really encourage them to ask themselves, right? What is different here? What is similar? I mean, I think that working through it, to your point of structured reflection, really helps you see these are about influence, forms of influence, and creating self-awareness about how you're showing up, what you have as levers or sources of power, to ultimately whatever your goals are. And on a personal note, you mentioned Celine Thieu, Agnes Lee. I had the pleasure, and I think I told you about this, right? A few years back, they are touchy-feely facilitators. We co-taught a course on power and influence. We designed it for the Schwarzman Scholars in China. So that was a fantastic experience for us as teachers, right? You want to understand something, you want to challenge the students, understand how to do that. So a side note there. Ed, there's many questions I want to ask, but I want to end on two here because I know we've got limited time. And the first one, you're in Silicon Valley. When you go to your very simple website, I know a couple years ago, there is EdBot. Which is very interesting, right? You know, large language model that was based on your prolific writing. You can go in and ask, you know, through a ChatGPT interface, Ed, anything. And so you are starting to explore and look at AI and, you know, would love to hear your reflections on, you know, how does this replace or complement us as coaching? I don't want this to be too pie in the sky, but, you know, how do you see it impacting the coaching world and particularly kind of the stuff that we do?
Oh, yeah. I think it's going to dramatically affect the all helping professions. And, you know, there are people far more qualified than I am to talk about both that topic, but more generally how AI, LLMs and other manifestations are going to affect the sort of, you know, white collar work. But let me say specifically, helping professions are already being impacted. And I mean that in the broadest sense, you know, we could think of, like, you know, customer service as a helping profession. And of course, you know, a lot of my clients are involved in, you know, ventures that have already developed reasonably lifelike avatars that are providing customer service to people in, you know, businesses all around the world. That's only going to continue and grow. We will ultimately see versions of it in therapy, mental health, and related helping professions. And so, of course, we'll see versions of it in coaching, which is not therapy, but is sort of, you know, adjacent. Very unclear to me exactly how this will evolve, but I certainly think we can make some bets that, you know, increasingly lifelike forms of AI agents will emerge that offer various types of sort of, you know, always on, readily available, and very low cost help. And so I think it's, you know, the EdBot, this version of ChatGPT that's trained on my website, developed by a guy named Tariq Karula, a coach and founder, is a somewhat rudimentary version of this that, you know, may grow more lifelike in any number of ways. I think of it, it's important for us as coaches to figure out how do we take advantage of these tools and make them available to clients and enable our reach to expand. I don't view it as a threat. And will it change the contours of the industry? Absolutely. My belief, though, is that there will remain something of value in a real-time human-to-human connection. Now, it's not that, you know, I'm not going to be bringing some basis of expertise. I mean, ultimately, you know, an AI coaching agent is going to have more expertise than I will be able to muster at any given moment. And I think there's some, we see interesting parallels in other domains where the human element, I don't know, it's a very simplistic comparison, but, you know, Swiss watches are not necessarily better timekeepers than, you know, the quartz mechanisms that were developed, decades ago. And yet there's still a very robust market for Swiss watches. Why is that? I think there's something about the understanding of the human element in the creation. It becomes something of a bespoke object that the individual has an attachment to. I think there's probably something similar going to emerge in the world of coaching and other helping professions, that we will find something of value, in the human-to-human connection while augmenting any work that we're doing with live humans with AI agents.
Well, man, Ed, you are the Swiss watch. You are the Swiss watch. I asked in a real quick other way here, EdBot is there. I encourage people to use it. It's pretty good, kind of bringing stuff back. I don't know how you feel about it, but ask it another way, right? You know, you have a certain number of hours. You have a long waiting list, right? So, like, where might it be useful for someone out there to, like, go use EdBot for certain stuff? Or what are they going to get that would be different with you live? Like, just, you know, what would be the main thing?
In fact, I think you highlight a way I began thinking about writing and generating content 20 years ago, when I sort of began this journey. I concluded very early on, and it was something of a result of the fact that I began writing at sort of the dawn of what we called blogging, with these platforms, but also an ecosystem in which the idea was, well, let's contribute to a shared commons of knowledge and make it freely available. And I decided very early on that I was going to essentially, charge people for my time and make my content freely available. And so everything on my website has always been available via a Creative Commons license, which means it's always not only freely available, but people can repurpose it as long as they, attribute it back to me. That has been, and even, I, as you mentioned earlier, wrote for HBR for many years, had a very warm association with them. Now they monetized that content. I didn't, and I ultimately took material that was published, essentially everything I wrote for HBR is also freely available on my website. And I view the development of this, version of ChatGPT trained on my website as just an extension of that same underlying principle, make the content freely available, and essentially monetize my time. And, I do think the part of the value, and I don't want to say the only value, but part of the value of a coaching relationship is a sense of a special connection that you have with an individual human consciousness that persists over time. It's not just a one-on-one interaction. You mentioned that I've worked with my coach, Marianne, for at this point, 16 years continuously. I'm going to see her in 10 days. I'm super excited about that. And I work with my own clients over a relatively long period of time. So there's something about that relationship and about that connection with another human consciousness that I think will always be special and valuable. And, looking to AI to augment the work that we're doing as coaches. I mean, I think that's, I feel that responsibility. It feels really important to me, and I'm delighted to be able to contribute in some small way with this ChatGPT on my website.
Yeah. Well, it's awesome to see it out there, and I can think of no one better to be experimenting with it in a responsible way than you, Ed.
Thank you.
Ed, as we're here at the end, anything I didn't ask that I should have?
Well, you didn't ask me how Buster was.
Give people the background and the context with Buster. Because this is the other very interesting point of connection. And again, I encourage everyone to go to Ed's blog. He shares a lot about himself. These last 2 years, your reflections being out on the ranch have been quite illuminating. But tell us about Buster. How is Buster doing?
Buster's living his best life. So Buster is our dog. He is a 100-pound, half Great Pyrenees mix. And we were on the ranch for 4 years, and he got me through the pandemic. Life on the ranch with Buster was much better than it would otherwise. At a point in common that we have are these two dogs, you know, both American and Spanish, but with this very shared history. And I know that you're Mancha's even bigger, right? He's 120 pounds?
Yep, exactly. Yes. So he has a Spanish Mastin. And what did ChatGPT tell us? They broke it down to an analogy that one is
a knight and a conquistador or something like that.
One is the hulking warrior, one's the gentle giant.
Your Mastin is the hulking warrior.
Ed, an absolute pleasure. Ed Batista, executive coach, dog walker, and cutting the future for us with EdBot AI. Thank you so much. And Ed, how do people reach you? I know it's edbatista.com. You prefer other mechanisms that they follow you?
Oh, no. Edbatista.com is where all my content is, and edbatista.ai is where this LLM is located.
Awesome. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks for listening to 97% Effective, where we skip happy talk and help you break through and ascend one hard truth at a time. Help others discover this show. Leave a review and rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you like what you heard, you can get free resources, including the first chapters of Michael's book, Get Promoted, on his website, www.changwinderoth.com. That's www.changwenderoth.com.